Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does anybody go from being a kid to being a criminal? Darius Clark Monroe grew up in a close-knit family in Houston. By his junior year of high school, he was taking AP courses and looking forward to college. But his dreams were sidelined by a colossally bad decision when he was just 16 years old. Monroe and two friends committed an armed bank robbery, and he was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Years after that, Monroe wanted both to understand what led him down the wrong path and to apologize to those traumatized by the siege at the bank branch. Darius Clark Monroe directed the documentary Evolution of a Criminal to tell that story. You can see it tonight as part of the Independent Lens series on PBS stations across the country, including KERA Channel 13 at 9 o'clock. Darius, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You seem to be a really unlikely person to have committed a violent felony or potentially violent felony. You came from a supportive family. You did well in school. You had a job. Tell us a little bit about your life as a kid.
You know, it's funny because I don't think I was. It's unlikely at all. And that's it's interesting because my childhood was essentially just pretty normal, pretty average. I came from a working class family. You know, I was the oldest child. We didn't struggle in terms of, you know, food on the table, clothes, shelter, all of those things were provided. And there was no point in my family or in my upbringing that I ever assumed or imagined that I would end up in prison. That was just not my destiny. That's not what anyone wanted for me. And yet it still happened. But I had a great upbringing and a great childhood, except for the fact that we were just, we were struggling financially. We were living paycheck to paycheck. And it just took many years for me to realize that that was our reality. I had assumed for many years that we were middle class, but that definitely wasn't the case.
Hmm. And you became, as you got older, more and more keenly aware that your parents were struggling financially.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And just from the, you can look around in the neighborhood and that the area was struggling. But inside the home, I can tell that, things were just getting stressful in terms of our finances. And it always felt like, even though bills were being paid, it just seemed that we were one check away or one, if we missed a check, we would be in serious trouble. And just as the son of the family, I just felt like I had it to help. And there was, my part-time job, I wasn't able to provide enough to make a true dent in our debt and a true dent in terms of the bills that we had monthly. And so it seemed like my options were just limited. And after watching an episode of America's Most Wanted, that's when this whole idea of this robbery happened after our home was burglarized.
Yeah, you were really traumatized by that burglary at your house. And you feel like financially that was kind of what put your family over the edge.
I think so. And, I was also 16 at the time. And so maybe, at 16, it's different for me now at 34. It seemed so much more dire at 16. But that robbery, that home burglary, it destroyed us. It crushed everyone. And this was during the holidays and, whatever little money we had to sort of, make the holidays nice. They were just really destroyed by the fact that, so much of our things were robbed from us. And I just felt like, we could get back to normalcy if I can get these things replaced as soon as possible.
So you hadn't really done much bad at all in the past, but your first sort of entree into the world of committing crime was thefts from the store that you worked for.
Yeah. And so, when my home was burglarized, I happened to be working at Venture in Houston. And it started with me stealing a few VCRs from Venture to replace the ones that were stolen from us.
And that, I guess it was it easier than you expected it to be to get away with that?
At Venture it was. And I think that's probably what, just led me down the wrong path as mm-hmm. well, because I tried with just taking one VCR and I didn't get caught. And, I took a couple more, and even though those VCRs replaced the ones we had, I could tell that it still wasn't making any just true impact on our household. And so it just seemed like stealing those things was a waste of time.
One really fascinating element of this film is that it illustrates how one person committing a crime, going to prison, affects a host of other people. It was really hard on your family. Before we talk about that, I want to listen to your grandmother's reaction when she learned what had happened.
We were at church, and Skylar told me, "Grandmother, they say Darius is in trouble." I said, "What?" She said, "But you know, that picture they got from the bank is real fuzzy, so they don't know whether it's him or not." I said, "Oh, I can't believe it. I can't believe it." And I didn't hear another part of the preacher say it.
That was Darius Clark Monroe's grandmother in the documentary Evolution of a Criminal, remembering the moment that she learned that her grandson was a bank robbery suspect. Her daughter had told her she'd received a windfall from gambling money when, in fact, it had been stolen. You know, you were like the apple, and it seems like maybe you still are the apple of your family's eye. It has to be hard, you know, using this flawed logic that you had as a teenager, but to then realize that you've disappointed a lot of people who were counting on you.
Absolutely. And there were just many times where I just, you know, exactly what you just stated, I felt that to my core, especially when I was sentenced, because my family had put in all these seeds for me to do well in life and for me to prosper and go to school. And so no one wanted this for me. And it just felt like a huge letdown for me, but for everyone. And it just felt like an embarrassment. And I just couldn't process how it all happened. And I think I was, for many years, obsessed with, like, how did this happen in the first place? How did I go from, you know, a son, grandson, brother, productive student, to being sucked into the criminal justice system? And you see how easy it can happen. It's not difficult to happen if you live in a community that's marginalized and impoverished. It's not odd for that to happen. It's actually quite common.
Well, when you mentioned being your family being kind of one lost paycheck away from real devastation, there's a huge percentage of Americans in that situation.
Oh yeah, and it's you know, it's ridiculous, because a lot of times people assume that folks, you know, just have an interest in getting involved in crime, that people just wake up and just want to commit crime, and that's not the case. Poverty definitely can influence criminal behavior, and you know, and because of just the situation you're in, you just feel like there's no other way out, especially when you see everyone working, people trying to strap, you know, as much money together to make ends meet. And it just feels like no one has access to this American dream. It's like, when are we going to get out of this? When are we going to move up in class? And it wasn't happening, and it just felt like it was never going to happen.
Yeah, like the promise was, if you do the right thing, you will eventually be rewarded, and you weren't seeing that.
I definitely was not seeing it. Mm-hmm. No, not at all.
So you mentioned you were watching like America's Most Wanted. Talk about that day and sitting around with your friends and starting to even talk about this in any kind of serious way.
Yeah, and it was strange, because I was actually, the America's Most Wanted episode aired when I was at home with my family, and we all were watching the episode, and we were surprised, because there was a guy on the episode who had robbed this bank not too far from our home, and he robbed it two or three times and was able to get away. And I don't even think I was, you know, I definitely was joking, but I was intrigued, and I said out loud at that moment, I was like, wow, if he can do this thing, you know, maybe I can come up with a cool plan. And everyone laughed, and I didn't think too much about it, but that idea stayed with me, and I just kept thinking, I was like, wow, is this a possibility? And if I do this, you know, would this help? Could this money help, and could it be done? And when I later hung out with Trey and Pierre and a few other guys, we talked about this robbery. And, you know, please understand that my home wasn't burglarized alone, that Trey's house was also burglarized, that there was a string of home burglaries, and that all of us, coming from situations of just living in communities with working class people. And so we were trying to figure out, you know, how can we do something, you know, quickly that wouldn't, you know, that would be able to provide for our families. And the bank robbery just seemed like the easiest idea outside of us working, which we were already doing. And it started off like a joke, and then it just gradually became more serious, and a few people dropped out, and the three of us remained. And you know, it just got to a point where we all realized that we were going to go through with it.
Did you guys consider in your mid-teens when, with all due respect, and I have teenagers myself, you're not at your smartest in terms of wise decisions.
Oh, yeah.
Like, did it occur to you that if you walked into a bank with guns, you might get shot yourself, or you might shoot somebody without wanting to do so?
Yeah, that definitely was definitely a subject for discussion. And, you know, it went from us not even having a gun. It started with, you know, maybe we'll have a note or maybe we'll have a BB gun. And then we decided to use a shotgun. And, you know, I don't want to give any spoilers away, but initially, you know, there was supposed to be no bullets in the gun. We were just going to use the shotgun as a, almost like as a prop. And we knew that that location did not have any security or any police officers because it was so close to the Stafford Police Department. It's about a mile away. But when you say that, and I think about that all the time because, you know, it is a state of Texas.
Right.
And, you know, you can have a concealed weapon and someone could have easily blew the back of my head off as we left that bank. And my mother could have received a phone call saying that your son died in the commission or was killed in the commission of a robbery. That's with me all the time about how many, there's just so many ways this thing could have been played out. And we didn't understand at 16. And it's sort of discussed in the film how your mind is still developing. And even though you may think you have it all or know it all at 16 years old, you really don't. And there's a lot of things that you're blindsided by and you just can't see the true impact of your decision and choices.
So you guys got out of there before police arrived on the scene. But I wonder if this, you know, sort of recent rash of news stories about police confrontations with young men, some, you know, largely unarmed, like how you think about those and whether they feel more personal to you than even sort of the average now successful young African-American man.
Yeah, they do feel personal to me because, you know, it's you know, I was actually committing a crime.
Right.
I was in the commission of the crime. And so if there was, you know, if the law enforcement came inside that bank that day, they would probably, you know, absolutely have the right to do so. So it's been difficult to watch and witness what's been happening across the country and what's been happening for many, many decades and centuries. Because, you know, these are young men who are not committing any crimes. Who are getting killed by police who is in charge to protect and to serve citizens. And so, you know, my relationship with the police department is different because, you know, we didn't have any interaction with the police other than being arrested. But there are folks who are being killed and having these interactions who are doing nothing but walking down the street, who are doing nothing but living and just being Black. And so, yeah, that's been a huge concern of mine and still is a concern.
Did you grow up feeling hassled by police, like before
you know,
any of this happened?
In, you know, it's I grew up outside of Houston. So I grew up sort of in the area, you know, it was working class suburbs down in Houston. And so I didn't have too much outside of the high school police officers. I didn't have too many interactions with the Houston Police Department just in terms of riding around. I think a lot of that was due to the fact that I was in prison,
mm-hmm.
that after this happened at 16, from 17 to 21, I was incarcerated. And so those are years where a lot of men are being harassed and having, you know, constant interactions with the police department. And I wasn't around. I was interacting with prison guards.
I was touched in a strange way by the detail in the film that when you were being arrested, and we'll talk about the details of that, but your school police officer, who was the one who handed you to the, I guess, city police officers,
right.
or maybe it was the feds, said, "Don't say a word until you have a lawyer."
Yeah, yeah, and that shocked me because I mean, Too Short is pretty stern. He's you know he's Officer Walton, who we call Too Short is you know I've known him for years, and you know he's a staple at that high school, and you know he didn't have to say anything, but when he told me that, it was like a small piece of comfort in a very traumatic situation because I really wasn't understanding what was happening. I knew I was walking down the hallway. And he was telling me that, you know, this was a serious thing that was happening. And it was like a blur. And that line of him saying, you know, don't say anything, it helped a lot because, I think I probably would have went in there and just said every single thing. And I didn't want to drag my family, my parents into this mess. And so
let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is filmmaker Darius Clark Monroe. His documentary, Evolution of a Criminal, airs tonight on KERA Channel 13 television. Back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Darius Clark Monroe. His documentary, Evolution of a Criminal, airs tonight as part of the Independent Lens series on PBS stations, including KERA Channel 13 Television at 9 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So you were saying that because you didn't, suddenly I guess it hit home to you that you didn't want to drag your family into whatever problems you had caused for yourself. You were also moved by Too Short, the police officer at your school, sort of giving you this bit of advice.
Yeah, just, you know, essentially just to keep my mouth shut, which is interesting, again, coming from the school police officer, until, you know, I was able to process what was happening. And because that was my first time in life being arrested. And it was for, you know, something very serious. When I walked into the assistant principal's office, the two detectives was there. They were there from the Stafford Police Department. And I remember them saying, you know, you are now, you know, you're under arrest for 7 counts of aggravated robbery and I think 7 counts for aggravated assault. And so those words, when I heard them, it just seemed very strange. Everything just seemed very out of body because I just couldn't even believe the fact that I had, let alone done the robbery, but that I was being arrested and being arrested during my chemistry 2 AP class and, you know, and being escorted through the hallways of the high school. And so all of that was a lot for me to process, and just having that small connection with Too Short, I think, just settled me down just a little bit.
What actually happened in the bank that day?
You know, so once we got out of the car and we walked through the door, I did most of the talking. Pierre was the gunman, and I had a bag. And I walked through the door, and I spray-painted the camera. And we had cased the bank a few times before then, so I knew exactly where I wanted to go, which was to the small safe that was in the back. And I just went and literally just said, you know, who has the keys or a combination to the safe? And I remember the bank teller telling me that she had the key and that the branch manager had the combination, or maybe it was reversed. But both of them went over to the safe and unlocked it. And all the money that was inside of there, I think there had to be a little bit over $140,000 that was inside of that small safe. I just took it and put it into the duffel bag. And during, you know, while this was happening, you know, Pierre was inside the lot, you know, the regular area of the bank, you know, with the customers, and they were all on the ground, and he got the shotgun, and he was telling everyone, you know, stay calm, stay quiet. And once I packed up the money, we left. We got out of there quickly. I think we may have been inside the bank for about a minute, a little bit over a minute, but that was about it.
Do you have any memories of, like, people's faces as they reacted to thinking maybe that they were going to be killed?
You know, the two biggest memories I have from that event was there was a woman. She is probably the same age as my mother, and she was the first person who I saw as soon as I came through the door. She was actually standing, filling out a deposit slip. And so as soon as Pierre and I walked through the door, she immediately threw herself to the ground and she started crying and she was shaking. And, I'll never forget that. I'll also remember the bank teller and the branch manager. They were standing right beside me when I was taking the money and putting it in the duffel bag. And they were also traumatized. And, I was almost like I wanted to yell out, like, hey, we are not here to harm anyone. But, emotional and psychological trauma, years later, I'm realizing, is just as impactful as physical trauma. And so that even though no one was harmed physically in that bank, you know, emotionally and spiritually, they were, you know, they were shook up. And to such a degree that when I came a decade later to speak with them, and when they talked, you could still hear the trembling in their voice. You could still hear their throat clench up. You can see their hands shaking. And it was like we were back inside of that place all over again.
Was there anything when it was first going on? I mean, obviously your perspective now is very different. Mm-hmm. Was it exciting to realize that all these people were going to do whatever you told them to do?
Oh, absolutely not. I wasn't, you know, I was so myopic at the time. You know, I was focused solely on the money. And so the people were just, you know, that's what took me so long to really come to terms with the fact that I was so disappointed that I didn't apologize, because the people were just there for me at the time at 16. I was really just wanting to go get the money and get out. And so the people were just there. We didn't touch anyone. We didn't ask anyone for their wallet or for their money. And so at no point in my mind did I even consider you know, how these people were going to be involved in this robbery and how they were going to play, how, you know, just what their emotions were going to be like. It just all felt like this blur. And so I had no intention of ever saying anything or doing anything to anyone.
So that afternoon you went back to school, like you guys committed the robbery and then you took off the clothes you'd worn and like returned to class. And then that afternoon you went home and took your share of the cash. And tell us what you did with it.
Yeah, I went home that afternoon and took my share of the cash and actually put it in one of my shoeboxes. And I placed the shoebox on my mother's bed. And my stepfather actually was off of work at that time, but he didn't know anything. And so he was in the living room watching TV. And my mom, when she returned home from work, I remember her walking right past my room, and she walked into her bedroom and she found the money. And she came back into my room and she had about $10,000 in her hand, and she was shaking. She was already crying. And she just kept asking me over and over again, where did the money come from? Even though the money had Bank of America wrapped right around it on the tag. And I told her, you know, that I did this robbery and that this is the money that's going to help us pay bills. And she yelled and screamed and she was angry and paranoid and in shock. And it was just a myriad of emotions. But we used that money to pay bills. Like, you know, once, you know, I wasn't, we thought that the SWAT team was going to come in that day. But as the days went on, you know, they decided, okay, well, are we going to use this money? Are we going to give it away? Are we going to call the police? But they helped they helped the household and they helped my family and many families in our family with their bills.
It's so interesting because in that moment that your mother realizes what's happened and she's so upset, like, I, as a parent, I can imagine all of her dreams and hopes for you kind of vanishing. And then on the other hand, she needed the money. And did your parents talk at all about whether they should turn you in? Did that even come up in conversation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for a lot of the conversations, you know, they talked amongst themselves. And so there were some discussions I'm sure I wasn't privy to. But I remember them definitely having a conversation. It was my mom, my stepfather, and my uncle Carrie, who had come over at the time, you know, because they had to tell somebody else about what had happened. And they didn't know. I try to explain to people what's been happening to Black communities across this country who are impoverished and working class. This has been happening, like I said earlier, for a long time. And so the relationship between the community and the police is often fraught. And so people, especially parents, are not just prone to pick up the phone and call the police to come, you know, snatch your child up out of the house. I think there was discussions about possibly taking me up to the police department, maybe. But they, you know, they really didn't know what to do. And in this case, you know, this is, you know, it's a gray situation. They knew that they needed the money. And so they were trying to hope that this thing would just go away. The problem would just vanish and that, you know, I would never get arrested and that I would never get in trouble again.
So for a while, it did seem that way for a matter of weeks, even though there was kind of like buzz around school and
a lot of buzz.
Yeah, the police obviously were trying to put everything together and put this case together. How did you feel during the weeks between the robbery and your arrest? Were there times when this wasn't on your mind? Were you able to kind of pretend it hadn't happened, or was it always there?
The paranoia was always there. Mm-hmm. I think I was also, in addition to the paranoia, I was also trying to figure out, you know, just I kept waiting for the arrest to happen. And, you know, with bank robbery, usually it happens pretty soon. And so by the time I was arrested, which was about almost, you know, 3.5 to 4 weeks later, I think you're right. I was in a space where I thought that things had calmed down enough where I could sort of get back to some semblance of normalcy. And that was the exact moment when I was yanked up out of that comfort zone and reminded of this crime that happened. Because while the detectives were talking to Pierre and interrogating other people at the high school, no one had said anything to me. There was no one knocking on my door, asking questions from the police department. The first conversation I had was the day I was arrested.
And it sounds like at the time, I don't know if it was bravado on your part or if you just really had this sense that, you know, you'd be fine if you went to prison. But there were people in your extended family who knew what you were in for, trying to warn you.
Well, I mean, you're talking about trying to warn me in what way?
About what prison would be like.
Oh, I mean, well, no, I hadn't even, you know, I knew that my uncle Kerry had gone to prison, but no, you know, the thing is, my family, no one had talked about prison to that extent. And it wasn't until I did the documentary that I knew, you know, what happened with my uncle Kerry and my aunt Carlos. But prior to that, I didn't even know my aunt Carlos went to prison. Again, you know, this, it happened to her when she was young, but no one in the family talked about that. And so, especially with me, because I just, you know, I wasn't, you know, they had deemed me as the one that wasn't going to get in trouble, that wasn't going to get sucked up into this mess. And so I hadn't really had a conversation about the police and the prison industrial complex and the justice system, none of that. Everyone thought I was just a nerd and going to go to college and get a job and just and do something positive and be successful. And so this whole thing disrupted all of that.
So they were worrying among themselves, but they hadn't said that to you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, everyone was.
There's an interesting interview, a brief interview with your English teacher who was like, essentially said, you know, I would have bet my reputation that this wouldn't be the kid, that Darius Monroe would not be the kid that, that this happened to, that who did this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And she meant that. And she's a great teacher. And I mean, to me, that just shows you this. There is definitely a stigma of who or what we believe are people who are capable of committing crimes. And it is sad because oftentimes, you know, we think it's these certain type of individuals, but it's, you know, there really is no makeup for someone who can commit a crime. We all have the capacity to make a choice that is illegal and that could be damning to our future and our family's futures. And there is no class or race or background. And yet, over and over again, you hear people in the film reinforce stigmas, reinforce stereotypes, reinforce what they've been fed from the media, what they've been, you know, told to believe for so long. And so the film is trying to subvert that because when she says, I would have bet my life, you know, that's extreme. And she meant that.
Now, obviously, this is out there, right? You can't, you know, that you've made this documentary and people can see it and they can Google you and figure this thing out. But what was it like between prison and then you went to the University of Houston, you went to NYU for your master's? How did you make decisions about who you would tell and on what terms?
You know, for me, once I was released from prison, I initially tried to tell every employer, you know, about my background and what happened. And I kept getting turned down in terms of just job opportunities. And the first job I was able to receive was at a place where they hired ex-offenders. And so, you know, being honest was almost shut down from the beginning because I just couldn't, every time I would try to bring it up for employment, it just, there was no opportunity. No one wanted to hear anything I had to say. And at University of Houston, it's just, my goal was to just be a student and to distance myself as far away from this robbery. And some of my close classmates knew just because we became really close friends, but none of the teachers. And the same thing at NYU. On the application, it states, you know, have you ever been convicted of a drug felony? And I had not. I'd been convicted of, you know, robbery. And so I said no. And at no point did it ever come up in my application or in my interview. And again, at NYU, I was busy trying to make films. I was trying to learn the craft of storytelling and the craft of cinema and editing. And so I just didn't feel compelled to tell the faculty and administration about my past. But, you know, but definitely there were classmates who knew about it for years and no one ever said anything. I'm surprised it didn't get out. But, you know, it's again, fascinating because you hear people who I love dearly who are at NYU, who are professors, state directly to me on camera that had they known about my past, I would have been stigmatized. I would have been denied an opportunity like a scholarship or a graduate assistantship. And that's real. That's very real. And I wanted people to see that this is still where society is, even at a progressive university like NYU, in a city like New York. You will still be shamed and you will still be persecuted for something that happened, you know, almost two decades ago.
Had I known this about you, I don't think you would have been my GA. And I might have said, oh, well, it's because of this. Well, he doesn't do this correctly, but it could be subconsciously. Can I trust this guy? Now that I know and I see what you're becoming, I didn't know you before. I see what you're becoming, and I think that this medium, it can pass on to younger people to say, you can change. You can do better.
Do you feel that I should have mentioned this, like, in my admissions before coming to NYU? I should have put it all out on the table?
I wouldn't have.
Why not?
That was then. This is now.
That was Darius Clark Monroe's graduate film professor at NYU's Tisch School of the Arts, surprised to learn that the subject of his documentary was his own life and the story from his own life. This is all another scene from the documentary Evolution of a Criminal that airs tonight on Independent Lens. When you hear that, Darius, this person who's been a mentor to you and who's very fond of you and your work, it's got to be hurtful in one sense that you're the same person, but this piece of information would change someone's opinion about you. And yet, I mean, I have to imagine you get it to a degree, right?
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. And it's hard. You know, we've been told, you know, we practice this thing, especially in America, where, you know, we talk about forgiveness, but a lot of times it's just talk. It's just words. We don't really act upon it. And so, you know, forgiveness is something difficult to allow people, you know, to create a space for people to change and to learn from their past mistakes. You know, people have to have compassion and empathy. And those are things that are not easy to come by in a society. And it's, you know, I'm hoping to use this film to force people to step outside of their experiences and have some compassion to see, you know, something that is pervasive. You know, we're talking about poverty, we're talking about this country. There are a lot of people who have gotten in trouble because they were struggling and they were in situations that were stressful and that were toxic. And they made some choices that, you know, jeopardize their future. But in order to reincorporate these people in society, we have to be kind and be forgiving. And, you know, Charles Blackwell was my professor who was in that clip you just played. And he is someone who I, you know, love dearly. And I was actually very happy that he was being blunt and honest about the fact that, you know, he would not have possibly given me a GA ship. And it's not just the GA ship. We're talking about a full scholarship. We're talking about health care. We're talking about it was $800 a month. So, you know, it's those are very real things that could have been denied due to my background.
We're talking to filmmaker Darius Clark Monroe. His documentary, Evolution of a Criminal, airs tonight as part of the Independent Lens series on KERA Channel 13 television at 9 o'clock. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest for the hour is documentary filmmaker Darius Clark Monroe. You can see his film Evolution of a Criminal tonight as part of the Independent Lens series on PBS stations, including KERA Channel 13 at 9 o'clock. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Darius, one thing that your film really made me think about is the fact that although in this country we love redemption narratives, right? We love someone who has turned their lives around. We're so happy to elevate them, and I would imagine people have patted you on the back. But absent that, we sometimes tend to assume that goodness or badness are like fixed traits, that, you know, we make exceptions for ourselves, but for everybody else, we assume they are only as good as the worst thing they have done.
Oh, yeah. And that's horrible, but it's true. It's true. And it's so fascinating to me because I'm like, humans, you know how complicated it is just right. To survive and just to live life. And so, you know, that even though it's probably not crime related, we're all flawed. We've all made mistakes and we all have regrets. And you hope that you're not being judged based on your worst mistake for life. You know that, you know, you hope that someone is not going to continue to condemn you because of that. But we do it all of the time. We do it all of the time. And it's fascinating when people come up to me and say, well, you know, you were a bad kid or you did this bad thing, but now you're a good person or you've done a 180. And I try to explain to people, I said, I'm the same person before the robbery, during the robbery, during prison. And I'm the person, same person that you're speaking with today. I've just learned and I've grown and I've, I just understand, I'm not going to waste my time getting involved in this criminal justice system, knowing that my freedom is at stake and that so many people were not afforded the same opportunity that I was. So many great guys are still locked up on Ferguson Unit in Midway, Texas right now, who are saddled with 60, 70, 80 years, who, you know, at the time when I met them, were already incarcerated for 15, 20 years and were ready, had learned and had made vast improvements, and yet they were still going to be punished and condemned and revoked parole repeatedly because of prior mistakes. And so, you know, I'm just hoping as a society we can move forward and we truly stop just talking, but we live in it and we act on having, you know, more compassion and more empathy for others. Because, yeah, nobody's perfect. I've yet to meet one person who's perfect.
What was prison like for you? I guess you were 17 when you actually went to the like state lockup. That's still quite young, especially for someone who, relatively speaking, before you did this bad thing, you know, had been a pretty, if innocent is the right word, kid. I mean, how did you learn to sort of be yourself, stand up for yourself, allow yourself to be vulnerable to the extent that you need to make new friends and tough so that nobody messes with you?
I mean, yeah. I mean, and also, you know, I'm no different from other people. So when I went into prison, I'm holding on to all the stereotypes and stigmas of what prison is based on what we've been fed in the media and in papers and just in general. And so I was terrified. And for, you know, it was, you know, prison was not easy. But what I was blown away by was that there were guys in there who were full of humanity, who were not, you know, monsters, who were well-meaning, really good guys who were going to college, who were getting GED classes, who were taking trades, who were not trying to take advantage. And I'm not saying that was, you know, the whole population of the prison, but those were, you know, I met some guys who were just incredibly resilient, and I surrounded myself with those people, and we were positive, and that's how I felt like I was able to survive and make it through that place, that I was able to be a part of just a community of like-minded individuals who were trying to make sense of this time, make sense of this loss of freedom and possibility, but still hold on to hope. And for me, I quickly realized that hope was a way to maintain one's sanity in a very insane environment. It was a growing up lesson, but it also just told me that I couldn't be judgmental, that I was in a place with murderers and other robbers and drug dealers, and yet I had to reprogram myself and not hold on to stigmas to be able to have a human relationship with these men, to be able to talk and have trust and not feel like someone was going to shank or stab me or someone was going to get raped. That wasn't the case. There were just some really, really great people who sadly will never, ever be able to see the light of day because of how much time they've been sentenced. And it was definitely a turning point for my life.
Did you gain any perspective on, like, recidivism in this country and why some people who maybe mean to make prison a really meaningful experience and they mean to get out and turn their lives in a positive direction fail to do that?
I mean, it's you know, some people just stumble because just of lack of support in terms of just maybe family or in the community. But people also have to step outside of that and go macro and get a full scope of this whole thing that, you know, we have a society that really wants to ignore the 2 million plus people that are incarcerated in this country. This is the leader in mass incarceration. And so we're in the business of keeping people incarcerated. And so for that to happen, you can't complain about recidivism, but then not allow people an opportunity to vote, to get a job, to go to school because of prior infractions or, you know, having felonies on their record. I've seen it. Like, you know, people may say to me, well, Darius, well, you had to lie to get into NYU or you had to lie on an application to get a job. But it's like we don't have a society set up to receive people with the truth. No one wants to hear the truth. No one wants to know that you had a felony on your record or you messed up, because you will be punished for it and punished repeatedly. No matter how much time you've served, no matter how much time you've been off of parole, you'll be punished repeatedly because of that transgression. And so, you know, I'm hoping that we can do better, but we, you know, it seems like we're not really interested in having that conversation. There's a whole lot of, again, talking about recidivism and how do we lower crime. But, you know, people really want folks to be, there are entities in this country, large entities in this country that wants to keep the prison industrial complex up and running. They want to keep that labor force in there. And for that to happen, you need people to stay in the prison and you need people to get out and go back in. And that's what's been happening.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have, looks like, Henri in the Colony. Hi.
Hi. I love the show. I just wanted to share an example of my own life, which is way less, but very similar. I got a DUI many years ago, just I think a Class B misdemeanor. As a result, I lost my job and then found it almost impossible to find another job in my industry. I talked to a person that they said, oh, yeah, no, your resume is great. I get you placed with all these people. And then I said, oh, well, how's your driving record? And I told them, I said, call me back in 8 years. And he was dead serious. And so I was unemployed for a long time, ended up losing my house and all of this. Another example really quickly, so I wanted to teach English in Korea. And so I went through the process, the application, did a Skype interview with the recruiter. She was excited, everything was set up. And at the very end, she said, do you have any questions? And I said, well, she mentioned a background check. I said, I don't have a criminal record, but I did, you know, have this DUI several years ago. And she was just deflated. Like, oh, my God, you wasted my time. You can't go to Korea, and you can't. And I was like, well, forever? Or, you know, just for, you know, there's statute of limitations. And she was like, no, never. I can't believe this. So I wanted to share that.
Thanks so much for your call. Anything you want to respond to there, Darius?
I mean, no. I mean, it's what he says is that is it's very common, and it saddens me because it's very common for that to happen. And it's you know, it's funny. He says the woman was deflated. So imagine how he felt. I'm sure he was deflated. And you know, it's like we are a very judgmental society, very hard and harsh in our judgment. And I'm trying to figure out what is the proper conversation to move people beyond that, because we're talking about individuals who are our fellow human beings. These men and women, they are a part of the makeup that is humanity. And so, again, if I know that I'm flawed and I'm sitting on the phone trying to deny someone else an opportunity, blaming them for being flawed, I'm a hypocrite. And so this level of hypocrisy, it's toxic. Because, you know, again, this, you know, he made a mistake with the DUI, but he deserves a right to improve and to learn and to have another opportunity. Does that negate every single thing he's done in his life that was positive?
What did you think would come of tracking down people who had been in the bank to apologize to them?
You know, I wasn't sure. It was hard for me to make sense of, you know, how they were going to respond to me, but I knew I wanted to hear, I wanted to hear their experience, and I wanted to get this thing off of my chest. I felt like I wanted to apologize, and I made it clear that, you know, at no point did they have to sit down and do an interview. You know, no one even had to agree to my apology or forgive me, but it was just something that was weighing heavy on my soul, and I needed to do it. And I, you know, I tried to track down everyone. We couldn't find everyone, but those who we did find, you know, it was a transformative experience to stand across people who were held at gunpoint and to hear them talk about, I didn't say I love you to my wife or my daughters. I thought this was going to be my last moment on earth. You know, that shakes you up. And it really put into focus what happened, that it wasn't just me running inside this place, taking this money and leaving. That people's lives were forever changed by that action. And just like my family and community was impacted, their families were impacted by this thing and are still impacted. And I just felt like it was necessary to have that discussion.
Is it worth your, like, emotional energy to wish you had never done this thing when all the wishing in the world won't change it?
No, and I you're right. It won't. And so I don't even, you know, and people ask me all the time, you know, well, what if... I'm like, you know what? It happened. I don't even know I don't know how to respond to a what if it didn't happen, because it did happen. And apparently this was a part of my life's journey. And so I'm just trying to, you know, even though I can't go back and change anything, you know, you can still say, I'm sorry. You can still, you know, you can still own up, you know, to what happened, because those people were just minding their own business that day. So whatever was happening from a systemic, familial, behavioral standpoint that influenced me to make that choice, that had little to do with the people who were just in that bank working and minding their own business.
How are your parents doing today?
They're doing well. You know, this has been a tremendous experience for all of us. They have been at the film festivals. They've been traveling with the movie. We've met so many incredible people who have had similar situations, even parents who are struggling right now with children who are incarcerated. And so to go from such a very low place of the day of me, you know, being arrested and getting sentenced to prison, to be at South by Southwest, to have the film coming out today on PBS. It's surreal, and it's a true blessing, and it's a testament to the fact that, hope and love, you know, it sustains.
You say that before you made the film, you had never really sat down and talked at length with your family about the robbery or the circumstances that drove you to it. What kept you from having that conversation?
I think life. I was just trying to busy myself with, like I said, I was trying to just do everything I could to move away from the whole prison experience and the whole robbery. And so when I was released from prison, I literally started going back to college the following semester at University of Houston. And I was a full-time student. I was working full-time. I had a part-time job. I was interning. And so I was super busy. And, you know, I was productive. And so everyone was like, okay, well, he clearly learned his lesson, so we can all just move on. And so everybody thought that that thing was just a dark chapter that I was done with forever. My family was surprised when I called them up in 2007 and said, hey, I think I want to do a documentary about this. Because they were like, we were just in a good place of forgetting about this thing. And here you are making us relive it all over again. But they're, you know, they were troopers.
Was it good for your family, you think, to finally sit down and let them say what they had experienced?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I don't think anyone had gone to an official therapist or counselor about it. And there's something remarkable about the camera. The camera is almost, you know, it's this authority that demands that you just open up. And it was great that they weren't talking to a stranger, that, you know, my family was having a conversation with me. And so the camera just became this invisible thing. And we were able to have a raw and honest discussion. And it was just remarkable to be able to hear them talk about their side of the story. Because I think a lot of times, again, when you hear about crimes happening and someone being sentenced, you don't really hear about everyone else who's impacted and what they were going through and all of their emotions and how everything is tied to this person or this one event. And when you think about, again, how often this happens, so many families are impacted by crime and so many families are impacted by incarceration.
Are you ready to start making films about other things now?
Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait. I can't wait. I can't wait. I don't think I'm ever going to talk about myself again.
Took you a total of like 10 years, right? Or 7 years?
Seven years to do this film, yes.
Well, it's a really fascinating piece of work, and I so appreciate you spending this time with us, Darius. Thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me. I truly, truly appreciate it.
Filmmaker Darius Clark Monroe directed the documentary Evolution of a Criminal. You can see it tonight at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 as part of the Independent Lens series. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Celine Alba. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.